And did you hear on my mind every hour of the day without your sweet inspiration?
It's Tuesday night. It's 7 p.m. on the Left Coast, which means it's time for the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. This is Tammy Jackson, and I'm welcoming you to an hour of sweet conservative inspiration. You can interact if you'd like to do so with comments and questions on Twitter during the show. Go ahead and follow me at Tammy J, T-A-M-I-J. Now, my first guest tonight is Arthur Herman. Arthur Herman, Ph.D., is the author of the New York Times bestseller, How the Scots Invented the Modern World, which has sold 500,000 copies worldwide. Pretty impressive. And he is the author of Gandhi and Churchill, which was a 2009 finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He has a brand new book just out last week titled 1917, Lenin, Wilson, and the Birth of the New World Disorder. Dr. Arthur Herman, welcome to the show.
Well, Tammy, it's a pleasure to join you. How are you?
I'm doing great. I want to dive right into your book. And full disclosure, as I told you prior to coming on air, I typically have the books ahead of time, read them in their entirety prior to all my author interviews. My copy is on its way. I hope to write a review after reading it, and then I'll have you back again. But I've read portions of the book and enough of it that I think we could really intrigue everybody and whet their appetites. Let's start out, Arthur. How did Lenin and Wilson rewrite the rules of modern geopolitics?
Well, the way I describe it in the book is that in 1917, these two men, these two intellectuals, one who had been elected and reelected as President of the United States, and the other one, a professional revolutionary who had been brought back to his home country of Russia, thanks to the interference of German agents, managed to make two momentous decisions. The first was Woodrow Wilson decided the United States would enter the First World War. That was in April of 1917. And then Lenin decided that he and his ruthless band of Bolshevik conspirators would take advantage of the weakness of the provisional government that had actually overthrown the Tsar. When we think about the Russian Revolution and the toppling of the Tsarist government, this was all done while Lenin was still in Switzerland in exile. When he decided that they were going to overthrow that government that had taken the place of the Tsar and impose their own communist dictatorship in its place. And when you think about it, for the next 100 years up until today, the great ideological conflicts that have convulsed the world and that have cost millions of lives, both in World War II and also in the Cold War, all flow from those two great decisions and from the great opposition between two ideologies that would arise from that. And what I wanted to do in the book was to really give readers and people interested in how do we end up in the world that we live in now, a picture of the origins and those two decisions and why they were made and what their consequences have been.
Yes, and what's really interesting is that there are points of similarity between Vladimir Lenin and Woodrow Wilson and divergent solutions that they come up with. Arthur Herman, would you contrast the ideologies of Lenin and Wilson?
Well, there's contrast, and yet there, as you just pointed out, Tammy, there's similarities. On the one hand, you think, well, you know, one was an American. He was born and bred in Virginia. was a professor at Princeton University in political science, and then became president of Princeton, and then went on to become governor of New Jersey and then president of the United States. The other one was, as I mentioned before, someone who'd been radicalized in his teens, a professional revolutionary conspirator, spent years in exile outside of his native Russia, someone who's heavily influenced by Karl Marx, by the idea of a world revolution that would bring about a dictatorship of the proletariat. And yet, in some ways, when you look at the two of them, they both had a similar idea, and that was, and it's an idea, Tammy, that I think in some ways still infects politicians today. And the idea that through political action that you can basically transform humanity. You can make the world into a, not just a better place, but a perfect place. And that through the overthrow of what you see as corrupt and decaying institutions, you can create a new world order that will bring about a kind of heaven on earth, you know, a kind of utopia.
Yes.
And what I explain in the book is that by doing that in 1917, these two men actually set in motion events that, instead of creating a new world order, create what I call a new world disorder. And that's the world of turmoil, the world of genocidal nationalism, of communism, of an American sort of sense of mission about taking on responsibility in wars and defending liberty everywhere, no matter what the cost, that we've all had to come to pay the price for. And that's why I wrote the book, was to explain how that world arose and why these two men made the decisions they did.
Yes. Something that's so interesting to me, Arthur Herman, is as you mentioned, both Wilson and Lenin believed that mankind had a nature that was malleable, that if raised in the proper environment, it was perfectible. To me, that worldview is the polar opposite of a conservative worldview or the founder's worldview that says that man is imperfect, thus we need checks and balances. And the Wilson and Lenin view, they would hold that if one could install a proper government with adequate controls, society would be just fine. And I think about the founders who I've read over and over in letters, writings, books, etc., that they envisioned a government of the people wherein people's inner moral constraints and belief system would control their behavior, not government. And yet, you know, they diverged, and Wilson and Lenin really, really changed history. Arthur, would you talk a little bit about what happened with Wilson's League of Nations? How did that affect us? What were the results of that League of Nations?
What you said earlier was very well put, and that is that you'd think that Woodrow Wilson, who was a Christian, and he grew up, his father was a minister, that he would understand that issue of human nature, that there is this imperfection, an imperfection which is part of why redemption through Jesus Christ is part of history and woven into one set of theological beliefs. And yet, in a way, as you were just pointing out, there's this idea that redemption can come not from some transcendent belief or a transcendent deity, but it could be achieved here and now through our actions in the world and through actions through politics. And it was a fatal flaw, both for him and for Lenin.
Right.
And what you were saying about the League of Nations is really ties in with this. And that was that somehow, if you could get the nations of the world to come together in a single place and to agree that there would be no more wars, there would be no more injustice, that human beings would live in peace and harmony, that all of the problems of the world and all the great conflicts and all of the sort of tragic circumstances under which human beings live in other parts of the world, rich or poor, these things would all disappear. And Woodrow Wilson decided America would enter into the war, into the First World War, not in order to protect American interests, not at all. No, I mean, think about it. Americans were dying in the submarine warfare that the Germans had launched, the most famous being the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915. 238 Americans, innocent Americans, had died in that. And not when Germany offered to Mexico the possibility that if the United States did decide to enter World War I, that Germany would help Mexico reclaim territories in the United States, Texas, and New Mexico, and Arizona, that there would be a second front that would open up. And when that secret telegram was leaked to the press, there was a huge furor. But even that didn't get Wilson into the war. He decided this would be a chance to, as he said, for the United States to exercise its power, its enormous economic power, to, as he said, make the world safe for democracy, to make this the war that would end all wars. And it was that utopian vision that led him to the idea that after the war, the nations of the world would all come together in his League of Nations, and that they would, in a sense, make all things right and clean up all of the kinds of controversies and international conflicts which had been part of the war and that followed afterwards, because it was as the great empires fell, Austrian Empire, the Turkish Empire, the Russian Empire, all collapsed as a result of the war, including Lenin's withdrawal of Russia from the war, that this could all be done through some great multilateral meeting and discussion. It's the same illusion, Tammy, that haunts people who talk about the United Nations. It's exactly the same sort of thing. And it was a failure then, and it's been a failure since, and we've all had to live with the legacy of that kind of sort of high-minded but really incompetent thinking about how world affairs work and how international bodies and the international community can really act in the real world.
Yes, and when you bring up the United Nations, I am no fan of the United Nations. I'm a firm believer in national sovereignty, and that nation would like to abscond our sovereignty. Plus, I always think it's a little bit laughable that they are ensconced on Manhattan there, in some of the priciest real estate in the United States of America, and yet we pay them millions and millions and millions of dollars every year just for the benefit of being part of that club. And it seems that everything...
And think about the parking tickets to write off as a result of that. I mean, it's a big chunk of the national deficit if you could actually collect on those parking tickets over the years.
Oh, my goodness.
It all springs from the same thing. All springs from the same thing. And this is what my book is really getting to, Tammy, is that kind of liberal internationalism, that globalism, the expectation that the United States will somehow merge seamlessly and frictionlessly with all the other nations in the world, that all that makes us one as humanity will come together in a single body. And that all that makes us different, and the differences are enormous. The differences in culture, the differences in sets of belief, the differences in where we are in terms of our economic and social development. These things are really to be ignored or passed over, and that a United Nations, or like Wilson's League of Nations, that this would all be taken care of through such an institution. These are the illusions that have haunted liberalism and haunted liberals ever since. And now I think in many ways, Tammy, if I may say, I think in many ways the election of Donald Trump represents a closing of that era. And I think the American elite still live very much with that illusion, but I think American voters, the ordinary people who put Donald Trump into office, have come to realize we've had enough of that. And it's time to return to the principles, as you were saying, the principles of American founding, the principles of national sovereignty, and that American power and American influence in the world needs to be exercised for the interests of America and its allies, but not for the mission that Wilson gave to us and passed on to the United States 100 years ago, the idea that we were going to save humanity from itself. And
yes.
I think we're seeing the closing of that kind of era. People have caught on. This is not how American power should be used, and this is not where America needs to be.
Oh, well said, well said. And I love it too, because the ending of the era of Obama saying we are citizens of the world is a good thing by me. I'll be back with Arthur Herman talking about his wonderful new book, 1917, Lenin, Wilson, and the Birth of the New World Disorder. The Dami Jackson Show is sponsored by Robar Companies. They are a true custom firearms and firearms finishing shop. They're located in Phoenix, Arizona. You can find them online at robarguns.com. I got to tell you, this is kind of exciting that Robar, and they are one company who will say Merry Christmas, by the way. They're offering a great special for this entire month of December. It is 10% discount on metal finishes of complete rifles, shotguns, and or pistols to include Norton specials, and 10% off all items in their pro shop. There's a lot of great stuff in there. There's aftermarket triggers. There's other parts of firearms. There are tools that you'll need in your range bag that are fantastic. So if you're wondering what to get for a gift or what you want to put on your Christmas list, check out robarguns.com, sponsor of the Tami Jackson Show.
You're on the 405.
Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the Talk Alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
The President and I have witnessed firsthand the compassion and commitment of Americans as friends, neighbors, and strangers continue to volunteer time and money to help one another following the recent hurricanes. Your help is still needed. Donate to an organization of your choice and volunteer to help your fellow Americans. Visit NVOAD.org. and ready.gov to learn more.
Whoa, a new digital music player. Thanks, Mom.
Oh, I'm glad you like it, because I can't wait to toss the big stereo. And now that we got your dad that big HD TV he wanted, we can throw out our old TV, too.
Hold up. You can't just throw out electronics.
Really?
They need to be recycled or donated.
And how would we do that?
It's so easy, Mom. Today, recycling electronics is just as easy as buying them. GreenerGadgets.org has all the info. We just enter our zip code to find a certified recycling center nearby. There are thousands of them, and new ones are being added all the time. Some of our local stores are even certified recycling locations.
I like that.
Did you know that some of the stuff in our old electronics could be used to make new products and conserve natural resources?
Well, okay then. Let's gather them up. What was that website again?
GreenerGadgets.org. We just enter our zip code and go.
I love Tami.
I love you back, Kurt, because I'm a caring kind of gal.
The Tami Jackson Show.
I'm just one conservative gal encouraging you to keep fighting the good fight.
Tami is what conservative insurgency is about.
Tami Jackson, the granddaughter of legal immigrants.
In Honduras, they had 60,000 murders per 100,000, or something like that. And I thought, whoa, that is a lot.
Like every other person on the block is dead.
Tami Jackson, the emerging threat from the West Coast.
Tami has made herself into a rising radio star.
When we have these mass amounts just suddenly pour into the United States, we have a worse problem than we already have had with assimilation.
The Tami Jackson Show, Tuesday nights, 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, only on the 405media.com.
Anything for you, Tami.
The 405.
This is is Tammy Jackson with my guest, Arthur Herman. If you're just joining the show, Arthur Herman, PhD, is the author of the New York Times bestseller, How the Scots Invented the Modern World, which has sold 500,000 copies, and author of Gandhi and Churchill, which was a 2009 finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. We've been talking to Dr. Herman about his brand new book that was just out last week, 1917, Lenin, Wilson, and the Birth of the New World Disorder. Now, this book, as usual, I have it linked on the show page by the title and the picture of the book. So after the show's over, you need to go, you need to grab a copy of this book, especially everybody listening. And I have a lot of listeners that are like me. They love politics. They love history, especially American history. Very, very fascinating in history of the West. We're going to continue on here talking about this. Arthur Herman, how did the policies of Wilson and Lenin affect modern geopolitics, especially when we're thinking about Donald Trump and other world leaders?
Well, I think what happened was is that when you look at the two men, Lenin and Wilson, what you really see them doing is setting up two different utopian visions of how the world can be made perfect through politics. And one would be consumed and subsumed in the idea of world revolution through communism. And Tammy, when you and I look back on the legacy of communism over the last 100 years, it's pretty terrible. We're talking about 65
yes.
million people killed and counting when we think about North Korea
yes.
and Cuba, which still remain communist dictatorships on as part of Lenin's legacy for the world and for history. When we look at the United States, of course, and Wilson, I mean, there's no comparison. I mean, Wilson's view of the world, his utopian vision, was not a world revolution. It was, I think you have to say, it was one that sprang up from his Christian upbringing, which was a world, that a future world of peace and harmony, of human beings living together in freedom and peace. It's just that as a man who, you know, was an intellectual, who was a college professor, he had no idea how to achieve that. He had no idea that the way in which this would come about might be through not the exercise of power of American power for, you know, achieving some great globalist vision, but America defending its interests, standing up for itself and for its sense of freedom, and joining together with like-minded allies to protect peace and stability. And when we look at the history of the United States as a superpower, and it's really in World War I, Tammy, that people talk about World War II and America's emergence as a superpower. It really was in World War I where America became a global superpower exercising influence around the globe through its economic power, its financial power, its military power. And yet, we can say, in the end, it was a good thing. We saved the world from fascism in World War II. We saved the world from communism in Cold War. But we also took on burdens that were beyond the capacity of any nation, of any people, to deal with and to confront directly. When we think about the legacy in Vietnam, when we think about the legacy in Iraq and Afghanistan, of what we can think about as America's overstretch and the idea that we could, you know, make the world safe for democracy and that we could turn any kind of people or any region into a haven of democracy and state building. This is the unfortunate side of Wilson's legacy. And at times, it has torn this country apart. And I feel in many ways we've now reached a kind of ideological chasm in our own country right now where the belief that America cannot do good in the world only if it stays away and doesn't exercise its power, which really infected the Barack Obama presidency, which is very much part of that Wilsonian legacy, the idea that we lead a moral example by leading from behind and declaring that climate change is a bigger threat than ISIS. I mean, how absurd. How completely out of touch with reality that was. And yet, it was that same kind of out-of-touch reality that led Wilson to believed that the League of Nations would save humanity from itself, that the United States military power could intervene and make a war end that would be the end of all wars. This is the ghost, of Lenin, a ghost of Lenin and a ghost of Wilson that wrote a recent op-ed for National Review. These are the legacies that we're now, I think, finally escaping from and getting away from. And from my perspective, what I see is a world in which the competition between great powers, including the United States and China and Russia, takes place on new foundations. And they could lead in more world disorder, but I think it may also lead to a new kind of stability. And what I see in Donald Trump is someone who has finally become our first true post-Cold War president with a new set of priorities, a new way of thinking about the exercise of American power. And frankly, Tammy, it makes me hopeful.
Yes, yes, really true. So Wilson and Lenin, as we come to the end of their lives, we've got a couple minutes left before we have to wrap, but it's fascinating. Both of them suffered strokes and they died relatively close in date to each other. How did that...
1924.
Yeah, right. And would you talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. And they were both men, I have to say, both men who I think were kind of, who had followed a kind of a tragic trajectory. Both men, broken men. Wilson had seen his dream of League of Nations defeated in the U.S. Senate. And America plunged into depression. We forget about this. There was a terrible depression in America, 1920. We think about the one from in 1929. But it was the depression of 2021 that the two Republican presidents, Warren Harding and then Calvin Coolidge, had to pull America out of and to restore economic growth and a sense of hope. And then in Lenin's case, the bankruptcy, the destruction that he and his Bolshevik party had wreaked in Russia, of the rise of Joseph Stalin, someone he deeply distrusted and thought would take Russia in a terrible and disastrous direction. But he was helpless because of his strokes and his paralysis to stop it. They died as broken men. They leave us a legacy, which in Lenin's case, I think, is unambiguously ugly and destructive. In Wilson's case, is more ambiguous. America, superpower, but America with a superpower, a temptation to take on more than it can deal with. And take on more missions than it needs to. And now I think we're in a position 100 years later to reassess their legacy, to think about their impact and how we escape from the kind of unfortunate circumstances in which they plunged the world. And I've written this book to make people aware of why they made the decisions they did, what the consequences were, and how we can point forward to a different and I think more hopeful future.
Fantastic. I've been talking with Dr. Arthur Herman. We've been talking about his wonderful book, 1917, Lenin, Wilson, and the Birth of the New World Disorder. As I said before, it's linked on the show page, both by title and by the book picture. So link on that, get a copy of that. Dr. Herman, I cannot wait to read the entire book. And when I do, I will write a review. And I wish you great success with this book. I'd love to have you back on again.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you. It's been inspiring to talk to you, and I hope we'll have a chance after you've read the book to renew our discussion and talk about it again.
Sounds fantastic. Take care. You're listening to the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. I'll be back on the other side of the break with publisher Stephen Strang. The Tammy Jackson Show is brought to you by Rent-A-Computer. An agent from Rent-A-Computer can save your company time and money on your next short-term need for a computer, audiovisual, or office equipment rental. Rent-A-Computer.com delivers the rental hardware your event needs to your office, trade show booth, or event venue location anywhere in the United States or Canada. Their offerings include Apple iPads, iPhones, Microsoft Surface tablets, and copiers. So if you're planning your next corporate event, remember, rentacomputer.com provides a superior turnkey event rental service with only one point of contact for clients both large and small. Visit rentacomputer.com or call them at 800-736-8772. That's rentacomputer.com, sponsor of the Tammy Jackson Show.
Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the Talk Alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
This is Mike from the Wrestling Mayhem Show, the show where we get fans and people in the wrestling industry together to talk about pro wrestling, WWE, NXT, WrestleMania, all kinds of fun. It's a podcast party. Check it out. Wrestling Mayhem Show right here on the 405 Media.
Listen to the Wrestling Mayhem Show now 7 nights a week, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, right here on the 405media.com.
On the 405.
I love Tammy.
I love you back, Kurt, because I'm a caring kind of gal.
The Tammy Jackson Show.
I'm just one conservative gal encouraging you to keep fighting the good fight.
Tammy is what conservative insurgency is about.
Tammy Jackson, the granddaughter of legal immigrants.
In Honduras, they had 60,000 murders per 100,000 or something like that. And I thought, whoa, that is a lot.
Like every other person on the block is dead.
Tammy Jackson, the emerging threat from the West Coast.
Tammy has made herself into a rising radio star.
When we have these mass amounts just suddenly pour into the United States, we have a worse problem than we already have had with assimilation.
The Tammy Jackson Show, Tuesday nights, 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, only on the 405media.com.
Anything for you, Tammy.
The 405.
The President and I have witnessed firsthand the compassion and commitment of Americans as friends, neighbors, and strangers continue to volunteer time and money to help one another following the recent hurricanes. Your help is still needed. Donate to an organization of your choice and volunteer to help your fellow Americans. Visit nvoad.org and ready.gov to learn more.
Happiness hit her like a train on a track.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Tammy Jackson, and I'm a little over halfway through the show on the 405. Now I'm joined by my guest, Stephen Strang. Stephen E. Strang is an award-winning journalist and successful businessman who began his career as a newspaper reporter at the Orlando Sentinel before founding a Christian publishing house and media company. While interviewing and writing about nearly every Christian leader in the country over the past four decades, Strang is CEO of Charisma Media and founder of Charisma Magazine. And Steve is the author of a new book just released last month, God and Donald Trump. Stephen Strang, welcome, and thanks for taking time to be on the show tonight.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
Well, your book looks fascinating. As an evangelical who voted for Trump, I'm more than a little bit interested. I want to ask you before we get into it, this is just impromptu, but you told me during the break that you're back in D.C. Have you heard anything about the SCOTUS hearing today on the Jack Phillips case?
I talked to a couple of attorneys at a dinner tonight who said, who didn't really say a whole lot about what happened. And we mostly talked about how the fact that the decision wouldn't be handed down until next spring. You know, the buzz up here is what's happening with Israel and the, you know, the announcement tomorrow.
Yes.
About declaring Jerusalem the capital, and it remains to be seen if he actually moves the embassy now or later. One person I talked to tonight said that he said to them privately that it wasn't a matter of if, but when. So it's always in come to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I haven't been there for a couple years. I was there for the Values Voter Summit in 2015 and had a fun dinner with a bunch of people. You'd recognize their names. And it's just fun as we all get gabbing back there. But that news about Jerusalem is very, very exciting to me. And I love that Donald Trump is keeping these promises. This book, as I've told a lot of people, Donald Trump was not my first choice, but when it became a binary choice, I knew I could never vote for Hillary Clinton. I mean, the winner of the Margaret Sanger Award in 2009, no way could I cast a vote for her. Inside the front cover of your book...
You know, she's far left, but so yes. are a lot of the other Democrats. But in her case, there was a level of corruption that we've not seen in American politics in this country.
True. And
so a lot of people were like you. I called myself ABC voter. That was anybody but Clinton. And yes. I was not a big backer of Trump initially. I was for Ted Cruz. But, you know, we began to see that Donald Trump was really different than the image you see on the media. You know, initially, I just knew him as a celebrity billionaire playboy. You know, I didn't know much about him. But right. about 10 years ago, something happened. He got much more serious about life. He cleaned up his act. He started watching Christian TV, believe it or not. And he would call some of the people and ask them questions about things he saw on TV. You know, the Lord, I believe in hindsight that the Lord was actually doing something in his heart.
Wow. Well, I know a lot of people said, well, he wasn't always pro-choice and he was a Democrat and all that. And I would tell them, well, listen to his story of why he became pro-choice. The friends that had a baby that were counseled to abort it. And then that baby turned out to be a fantastic person with no issues. Things that really did convert him to the pro-life viewpoint. And as he has had further counsel with fantastic people that I know personally, and I'm sure many that you know that have counseled with him, talked with him in person, he is a guy that takes in the information, thinks about it, and makes decisions based on that information. He doesn't come to everything with a closed ideological mind so much. So he may not be a hardcore conservative, but as people give him good arguments and good reasons for being pro-life and pro-Israel and so forth, he takes that in and he is willing to accede those points and to change. And I have seen some amazing changes in the guy. It's really something else. I haven't...
You're absolutely right, and he's not perfect. Of course, none of us are perfect, but, you know, God has always used imperfect people. I mean, just look at the scriptures. And I believe, and this is one of the themes of my book, God and Donald Trump, is that there was a spiritual dimension to this. It was a miracle. I believe that God raised him up. Now, you know, what I have said to others is Hillary Clinton wrote a book that says, What Happened? My book answers the question, and the answer is that it was a miracle, and God answered prayers of a lot of people like me who were just very concerned about the direction the country was going in. You know, what is going to change it? Well, the Lord answered in a way that we never expected with a person we didn't even necessarily like, but he's a change agent, and he is delivering on the things he said he would do. He has really rallied to the kind of causes that Christians and other conservatives think are very important. And he's become a champion. Unlike some of the presidents, certainly not President Obama, he had the country was headed in the wrong way. But, I mean, even George W. Bush, fine evangelical Christian that he seems to be, he didn't really champion our causes. He didn't talk about repealing the Johnson Amendment. You know, we could go on and on, but Donald Trump is doing all of these things. But it gets down to this. I'm reading, I've read several books on Trump. In fact, I got a new one today. And the secular ones don't talk about the spiritual aspect at all. Of course, they don't think that the spiritual aspect has any thing to do with what's decided. Even a lot of Christians think this. A lot of the conservative Christian activists, they never talk about what is God's will. They just don't. I mean, these people are our friends. They often they'll meet with politicians. It'll be all about policy. A lot of them like to have a place at the table, as the expression goes. But they never pray, or at least in the meetings that I've been to, and I've been going to meetings at the White House since George H.W. Bush, was elected. And there weren't even prayers prayed. But with Trump, he gets together with these preachers and televangelists and so forth, and they gather around him. You've probably seen the pictures. And lay hands on him, and they pray for him. And somebody will take a little video on their iPhone, and it ends up on YouTube. And he's done this not once, but many times. He seems to enjoy it.
Yes, yes, I've heard that. You write in chapter one of your book, God and Donald Trump, outlasting a field of 16 other GOP contenders while attracting the largest number of evangelical voters in history, the New York billionaire had delivered a stunning blow to his Democratic rival and sent shockwaves of amazement and disbelief across the nation and around the world. By some miracle, the Donald had actually won. Now, I remember that so clearly, Steve Strang, on election night, as the unlikely states began to be called for Trump and the Hillary disciples at her glass HQ in New York City, they began wailing and gnashing of teeth. And I was just amazed. But I'll tell you, the week prior to the election, my pastor and I go to a great church. It's called Athey Creek Christian Fellowship. I'll say it on air. It's here in the Portland metro area, and we've got thousands of people that go there. It's growing so fast, we keep having to add services. But our pastor, who's an expository verse-by-verse kind of guy, he took a sermon to say, who am I going to vote for? Now, he didn't say the names. He didn't have to. And he pretty much said, as biblical people, as people who rely on that book, as Christians, we need to vote for the person who will be pro-life, who will be pro-Israel. He said those are two huge things. And he said, and it's very clear by the Republican and the Democratic platforms and by the two candidates themselves, which one is pro-life and which one is not, which one is pro-Israel and which one is not. And he said, if we can get a president who would move our embassy to Jerusalem and declare that the eternal capital of Israel, I believe blessing would fall on America. And I wrote an article that went almost viral after that sermon talking about what he had said. And I thought it was fantastic. And I'm sure it was replicated in churches around the nation, Steve.
Well, I agree with you. What your pastor said was absolutely true. You mentioned election night. I was actually in the New York Hill room where Trump came out at 2:45 and gave his acceptance speech. And the reason I went is because I believed he'd win. Now, I was invited by Pastor Daryl Scott, who's an African-American pastor who was very, very involved in the campaign and even spoke at the Republican National Convention. And he's a friend of mine, and he said he thought he could get me in. And lo and behold, he did. It was a great experience. And, you know, it was very noisy. We were all kind of packed in there like sardines, to use a cliche. And we went in at 6:30 when they opened the doors. And as I said, he didn't come out until 2:45. I know, because I was taking an iPhone video and, you know, it times it. But anyway, at one point, I remember on the screen that said Clinton had 68 and he had 67 electoral votes, and he was behind one vote. After that, I don't remember him being behind the entire night, because I kept trying to do the arithmetic. Now, let's see, there's a whole bunch of states out. Is it possible she could get enough to catch up? And of course she didn't. And, you know, they were showing on the screens in our ballroom what was happening over at the Javits Center. And it was like a funeral wake. And like you said, people were crying, and they couldn't believe it. But yet, you know, the American people had spoken. And I believe that there was a God element in it. And that's why I wanted to write the book. I wanted to kind of put it on the record. I felt like I was writing history, so to speak, and trying to make it a part of the discourse by doing lots of media like this and, you know, religious media as well as secular media, and talking about, you know, where is God in all this? Is really sovereign like we Christians believe? Well, if he is, he has a will. The Bible clearly says he put, you know, he determines who's in power. And I believe that it was his will that Donald Trump be elected. And that is kind of the central theme of my book, God and Donald Trump.
Yep. You write in the book, God and Donald Trump. Donald Trump never claimed to be a paragon of virtue. In fact, he has admitted repeatedly in interviews with reporters and biographers that he had been rude and undisciplined for much of his life. But evangelical leaders who have met with him, as I have, believe he understands the importance of sincere faith. And, especially over the last few years, he has made a sincere effort to expand his knowledge and his fluency with essential Christian beliefs. Now, something that's very interesting, and I noticed this, and Steve Strang, you have a graph on page 11 of God and Donald Trump, which is astonishing, though completely believable. It shows the percentage of negative versus positive media coverage of Trump and Clinton. And for instance, CBS, 89% negative for Trump. USA Today, 88% negative. WAPO, 87% negative. And even Fox News was 73% negative. This is some amazing stuff. And Trump overcame all that, Steve Strang.
You have to call it a miracle. In fact, at the election night party, I mentioned this story. I don't mention the person's name, but somebody introduced me to this businessman. He kind of whispered in my ear that he was a billionaire friend of Donald Trump. And so I found it very interesting to visit with him because we were whiling away the hours. And he was obviously not an evangelical just based on his conversation. But he said, and this was like maybe, you know, 3 or 4 hours before the election was called. He said, if Donald Trump wins, it proves there's a God. And so I say, why? He says, because it'll be an absolute miracle. And I think that, you know, his kind of offhand comment, I think, was very, very accurate. It was a miracle. How do you, people say, why? How did this happen? Well, guess what? It was a miracle. You know, yes. Nobody expected it. Even the day of the election, most people weren't expecting it. But God did speak to leaders, to pastors, to, you know, what I would call modern-day prophets. And I document this in the book. In fact, we put it in Prisma magazine even before the election because I kind of wanted to get it on the record. There were four different prophets. I actually saw one of them tonight at this meeting in Washington, D.C., who didn't say he might be president. They said he would be president. This was against all odds. Now, we all, any of us who've been around the prophetic know that, you know, prophets are sometimes wrong. You know, the Apostle Paul said in Corinthians chapter 13 that now we see through glass darkly. And that's kind of how I, you know, explain seers who don't always see things correctly. In this instance, they were absolutely right. He was elected. And, you know, I put it in there partly to give glory to God and to remind Christians that we need to not just look at things from a secular point of view. We need to not be motivated by what we believe based on what we see and hear in the media. We've got to have spiritual discernment. We've got to see what God is doing, and we've got to follow the leading that the Lord has. And so I got behind Trump 100%. Part of the reason is because I had the opportunity to interview him on August 11th, 2016. I asked for 20 minutes. I was given 10 minutes, and I was very careful to you know, a 10-minute interview on TV is very long, but
yes,
when it's print, like it was for Charisma Magazine, you know, we recorded, of course, and transcribed it. In fact, the transcript is in my book, God and Donald Trump. And he was very respectful. He focused on my questions and what we were talking about, gave me good answers, did not seem preoccupied with whatever he was doing next. And of course, you know, it's just, you know, one event and one interview after the other all day long. And I didn't expect him to be like that. You know, I expected him to be kind of haughty and, you know, like we see in the media, but he was actually kind of humble. He seemed, and I'll give you an example. I told my two colleagues who went with me, I said, we don't have much time. Let's not waste any time with pictures. We don't want to bother him. He said to us, I guess we had an extra minute or so, he said, do you want pictures? So we all posed for pictures, of course. And also he offered me a bottle of water. Now that doesn't seem, you know, that important, but he went over to get himself a bottle of water. He asked me if I wanted one. There was absolutely no reason for him to do it. There's no protocol. When you do an interview, you don't, you know, serve food and drinks to the interviewer. You just don't. He just did it being nice.
Yes.
And it just really stood out to me that he's very, very different than people portray him in the media, where some of the people are just so anti-Trump. If he says that today is Tuesday, they'll say, no, he's lying because it's already Wednesday in Australia. I mean, just anything he says, they'll disagree with.
Yes, I agree with you so much. And your account is very similar to other accounts I've heard from friends that have had the opportunity to meet with him, that he displayed graciousness and a bit of humility that was almost disarming. So that I really, it's interesting.
And, you know, there were some public times that in the Republican convention when he was giving his acceptance speech. He talked about the support he got from evangelicals, and he was reading a teleprompter, and he went off script and said, I'm not even sure I deserve it. Well, that shows a certain amount of humility, doesn't it?
Yes.
Now, pastors, I was not there, but it was reported to me, and I put it in God and Donald Trump as an example. He said to these clergymen, he said, while you were pursuing a higher calling, I was out making money. So that shows that he has a certain respect for the clergy and considered what they were doing a higher calling. To me, that also shows a certain amount of humility.
Yep. Go ahead.
The people who know him well and work with him almost are raving fans. You know, he must be doing something right. He keeps employees a long time. You know, if people are doing a good job, he rewards them. And I'll just mention, for whatever it's worth, the meeting that I'm at here in Washington, D.C. is at the Trump International Hotel. You know, I'd heard about it. I'd never been here. It is absolutely spectacular. And while he probably wasn't personally involved in every detail, especially after he started running for president, I mean, you know, it's just obvious to me that he does everything with excellence.
Yes. Yes. I read his book, The Art of the Deal, when it very first came out years and years ago. And I remember talking to my dad about it, telling him, this is so interesting. I remember about him getting involved in the skating rink in Central Park and just so many different stories that I thought were fascinating.
Yeah, the city of New York was spent how much money and how many months and maybe years?
Yes.
And they couldn't seem to get it done. And you know, he said, I'll take it over and do it. And he did it under budget. And in less time than the deadline. I mean, it's incredible. Part of that is what you get from the private sector, from an entrepreneur, a businessman like he is, as opposed to just, you know, government bureaucracy, which often just bungles things.
Yes. And one of the things I took from that book, Steve, that I thought about during this whole election is that he admitted that he didn't know the first thing about skating rinks and ice. And then he said, but I know who does. There are experts in Canada where they have the best skating rinks, where they have the hockey teams, etc. And I was sure to bring on the best there were to tell me how to do it and get it done right. And to me, I kept thinking about that, that people think he's so haughty and so forth. But yet here's a man that is teachable and will listen and take in information and think about it clearly and reasonably. And so that really flies in the face of a lot of the stuff we'd heard. We've just got about 1 minute left here. You think that 2020 will be another big win for President Trump, don't you?
Yes, I do. I wrote an op-ed that said, I agree with Steve Bannon, who actually I'm meeting with tomorrow morning. He said that he thinks he'll get 400 electoral votes. And I said, I think he will, because I see a groundswell of support. And a lot of people that were a little iffy are actually coming around when they see what's happening with the economy and a lot of other things in our country that are, you know, beginning to move in the right direction.
Wow. Wow. I mean, this is going to be so exciting, because I see what he's done, starting with Justice Gorsuch, and then he is gradually getting originalist judges in all the federal courts where Obama had them packed with activists. This move towards being a greater friend of Israel and acknowledging their capital, being all these pro-life measures, the anti-regulation, getting the economy going, protecting us. There are a lot of good things that he's doing, Steve Strang. And your book, I suggest that everybody click on the title and on the picture and get a copy of God and Donald Trump. Steve Strang, it is so great to meet your acquaintance. The time has gone too fast, and I pray that God continues to bless your endeavors. I'd love to have you on again sometime.
I would love it. It was a privilege. And I'll just mention that today we found out it's made the Christian bestseller list. And
oh, wow.
So that's pretty exciting.
That's very exciting. What a fantastic thing. And I can't wait to read the whole thing. I've read parts of it. Thanks again, Steve. You take care.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. The Tammy Jackson Show on the 405 will be back next week with more great guests. Until then, this is Tammy Jackson reminding you to wake up. Don't be silent. Let your voice be heard, because you and I have a country to save.
Cut my teeth on the back of an old church pew. I learned to walk in the ways of light and truth. And I was told not to speak till I was spoken to. I heard it preach what I should and I should not do. And the choir sang, boy no more. I've seen some things that a man just can't ignore. And this world's gonna see what I'm standing for. I've kept my peace, but I can't hold my tongue anymore. You can't buy my silence. You can't steal my voice. You can't keep me quiet. I will try to beat me down, tell me to shut my mouth, but there's a time to speak, and the time is now. Oh,
can't steal my voice. You can't keep me quiet. I will bring the noise. Try to beat me down. Tell me to shut my mouth. But there's a time to speak, and the time